I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:32 p.m. Tuesday, February 28th, 2023. Welcome to House Finance. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Stapp, Representative Ortiz, Representative Kronk, Representative Tomaszewski. And helping us today from the LIO is Emma Turner. Our finance secretary is Bree Wiley. And today we will be receiving a presentation from the Department of Education and Early Development, followed by a presentation from the Legislative Finance Division on the history of the base student allocation formula. Presenting today for the Department of Education and Early Development will be Heidi Teschner, the acting commissioner, and Sabrina Xavier, administrative services director. Acting Commissioner Teschner, would you please come forward, put yourself on the record, and introduce your staff.
Okay, good afternoon. Chair Johnson and members of the House Finance Committee, for the record, my name is Heidi Teschner. I am the Acting Commissioner with the Department of Education and Early Development. With me is Sabrina Xavier, our Administrative Services Director. It's okay. She'll put herself on the record in a few slides. And also, we have a number of folks, lifelines in the room, to help answer any questions you may have as well as on the phone. So hopefully we can get all of your questions answered this afternoon.
All right. Welcome to House Finance. Let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Galvin.
And I'm going to move on to slide two. So slide two provides this committee with our mission, vision, and purpose. Our mission is an excellent education for every student every day. Our vision comes out of Alaska Statute 14.03.015. And our purpose, we exist to provide information, resources, and leadership to support our mission of an excellent education for every student every day.
And let the record reflect that we have been joined by Representative Colom.
Moving on to slide three. So about 5 years ago, parents, students, educators, policymakers, tribal leaders all got together and answered the call of Alaska's call to action to create a shared vision for improving our public education system. And that outcome was the Alaska's Education Challenge. And we have these five shared priorities that guide all of the work that the department does. And I just want to make sure we've had a number of senators, representatives that participated in that. And so the work of that, implementing that, continues. So slide four, we're providing an organizational chart that outlines the structure of the Department of Education and Early Development. The commissioner of the department reports to our State Board of Education and Early Development. The State Board is appointed by the governor and consists of 9 members, including a military advisor and a student advisor. The commissioner provides leadership and direction for the department. There are 5 divisions that provide service to our pre-K, pre-kindergarten through 12th grades, and includes the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence, our Division of Finance and Support Services, our Division of Administrative Services, Mount Edgecombe High School, and the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. We also have 3 boards, commissions, and corporations that fall under the department administratively, and that includes the Alaska State Council on the Arts, the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and the Alaska State Council on the Arts. And some upcoming slides, Administrative Services Director Ms. Xavier will walk through a little bit more detail on the budgets of each of these divisions and components.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Ms. Teschner, the Division of Finance and Support Services shows as vacant. Can you tell me how long that position's been vacant?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, that position has been vacant for a little while now. I don't have the exact time frame on top of my head. We do have an active recruitment. We're close to closing and hiring for that position.
Follow-up. Just help me narrow down a little while, if that's been a year or if it's been just a couple months and did we lose somebody to retirement? A lot of our presentation today is going to be about financing for schools, and having that division empty draws my attention, and so I'm looking to figure out problem solving down the road of how long have schools not had that support, or is it just a normal transition of somebody retired and we're in the recruitment phase, or has it been a year?
Representative Hannon, through the chair. So it's been vacant for not quite a year. We've had, I promoted up into the deputy commissioner role, so therefore I used to fill that role. I'm still supporting the staff in there. We did have somebody in acting status for a while. Currently, I am helping fulfill multiple roles with the department, including the Division of Finance and Support Services. So there's been no lack of support for districts in that area.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, moving on to slide five. This just reflects the same organizational structure, but includes the budget terminology that's used as we develop our appropriations budget, the appropriations bill and the budget. This may help you in locating where funding is located in the department in certain areas. So, for instance, if you're interested in what the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence, the work that falls under that division, the student school achievement component, teacher certification, early learning coordination, and pre-kindergarten grants all fall under that division, as an example. On slide six, this just provides the committee with a graphical representation of the department's operating budget and position history from fiscal year 2022 through fiscal year 2024, governor's amended. The bar chart represents the funding sources that make up the department's overall budget. So the big, the dark blue line, that's our unrestricted general funds. The lighter blue is our designated general funds. The orange bar is our other funding. The federal funding that the department receives is in the gray, and then the darker green is the federal COVID relief funding that the department has received. You will notice in the fiscal year 2024 governor's amended column that's slightly grayed out, that green bar, and that's because it's an estimate of what we think will be carried forward. We have our federal programs will allow us to carry over money, so we don't know how much federal COVID money will be carried over into fiscal year 24. It's going to be dependent on when districts and other grantees request drawdowns and submit those requests for reimbursements on those funding. So it likely will not be $360 million, but we don't know at this point what that will be. On average, our fiscal year 2022 through fiscal year 2024, our unrestricted general funds make up about 67% of our budget. Absent our COVID funding, it's about 79% of the overall budget. And so for fiscal year 2024, the total operating budget is $1.65 billion. This number does not include the $360 million COVID relief money. If we added that, it would be about $1.9 billion. And so the majority of the unrestricted general funds that the department has is about 94% of it, about $1.213 billion. Is our foundation funding formula and the people transportation program.
All right, we have a question. Then we have a question from Representative Cronk, followed by Representative Ortiz, followed by Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, how much money is impact aid comes back to the state?
On average, through the chair, Representative Cronk, on average, we take about between 70 and 80 million into consideration in the foundation funding formula.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. Ms. Teschner, for the listening public, more than any other reason, you said that's our foundation formula, the UGF, also known as the BSA, just for clarification.
Through the chair, that is correct.
And as a follow-up on that, can you tell me, I assume it must be for declining enrollment, but the number for the BS, no, that's not true. Can you tell me the reason why the number has gone down for the BSA FY23 to FY24?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, so just to clarify, not the full amount that's in the unrestricted general fund line is all foundation and pupil trans. A majority of that is about $1.213 billion of that. So there's a small portion that is not general or not for those either one of those programs. The fiscal year 24 budget was built on projected counts. So districts forecasting what they think they're going to have in student counts for the following year. And so that's what builds our budget. And then we true it up through the October count period every year, and then we pay based on what the students they actually served during the year. So this number that was incorporated to build the budget for fiscal year 24 will be trued up after the October 2023's count period.
Follow up?
And so I think to understand you the correct way, what you're saying is that lesser figure, the 1.361 compared to an FY23 compared to the 1.285, is a result of projected enrollment decline. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Chief, that could be part of it. I don't have the actual details, and I don't know if Ministry of Service Director Ms. Javier can speak to the actual differences in there. I know there's been other budget changes. There was a change from for the APS and moving from unrestricted general funds to the higher education fund. So that would have contributed to a lesser amount in 24's unrestricted general fund line. So there's a few other things that would have contributed to beyond just, because you can see even in the designated general fund line, it went from 2.7 million up to 25.9 million. Mm-hmm. And so part of that was a switch between UGF and DGF. So it's a combination of some multiple factors.
Last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that. Was there, if I'm recalling correctly, in last year's budget for this year, for FY23, there was a one-time increment. Was there not? And was that within that number as well? Or is that not within the number? And help explain the difference.
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, that is actually, yes, there was a $57 million outside the funding formula that was unrestricted general funds, so that would have been in the 23 column. That's not in the fiscal year 2024 column.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stout.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Teschner, so Representative Ortiz actually stole all of my lines of questioning, but I figured I would still take this opportunity just to point out all the wonderful folks we have in the crowd. Privileged to know a few of you over the years. This is Miss Susie from Mount Edgecombe, Bill Hill from Bristol Bay, and of course Shannon from Bristol Bay as well. Thank you all for being here and listening in on this meeting. So that's all I have to say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stapp. All right.
I'm going to move on to slide 7 now. So this just continues our fiscal year 24 governor's amended budget, and it includes approximately the 3 points. $316 million in federal COVID relief funding that was shown on the previous slide, so a total budget of $1.97 billion. The pie chart on the left provides by line item how the budget is broken out. You'll see that the largest portion in the green is now 94% of our budget is grants, pass-through grants to school districts and other entities for the programs, obviously including the foundation program, people transportation, our other state-run grant programs, as well as all of our federal grant programs, the title programs that go out to Title I, fiscal, special education, all of that would be incorporated into that green portion of the pie. And then the pie chart on the right provides just a breakdown of our divisions and our components and the amount associated with each. And if there's no questions on this slide, I will pass the presentation over to Ms. Javier.
Representative Galvin, before we move on.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. If I could, I'd like to go back to slide 7 through the chair. I'm looking at innovation and education excellence, and my understanding is you slipped the early development part of DEED into that section. So anything related to the 60,000 or so kiddos at 0 to 5 years old, roughly, it would be within this category?
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, we at the department pretty much serve 3 to 5s. The 0 to 3s are pretty much the Department of Health. And so any of our pre-K grant funding that goes to school districts, and the early education funding, the $6.8 million, I think, approximately, that we provide to Head Starts would be all included in that early education, early learning component and our pre-K grant components under this division.
Thank you. Follow-up, please. So for the 3 to 5 year old population, then could you tell me roughly how many students you have who are getting some form of care, or rather early education?
I was looking at a lifeline. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I'm going to have to get back to you. I don't have that piece of data in front of me.
Okay. Do you know, I think you gave me a dollar figure.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, there's about $6.8 million that is considered, that goes out as grants to Head Start entities, and it's used towards their match requirement.
Thank you. Through the chair, if I could have one more follow-up. Can you please tell me then what the match dollar is for that? I know it's federal funds, mostly through Head Start. Do you have that dollar amount?
Representative Galvin, through the chair, I don't have that. We don't have that dollar amount in front of us. I really apologize. If we can get back to the committee, that would be great.
Thank you. Through the chair, if I could have one that last comment.
Yes, but I want to make note that we do have another presentation here, and I want to make sure that we have enough time to go over the BSA formula, because it's important that we're familiar with all the components to it. So I don't want to, I'm not trying to shut people down, but on the other hand, I want to make sure we have time to address both pieces. So
thank you so much. Since this is the only time we can really address early learning at the 3 to 5 year olds, I'd like to put a word in that I really would appreciate hearing the data around how many students are being served presently and with how many dollars, with an eye on specifically your mission of making sure we have our kiddos ready to read. I certainly want to make sure that they're arriving at 5 years old ready. And so as much as we can track the dollars and the investment for that, I really appreciate it, Chair Johnson, to get those figures to us. Thank you.
And through the chair, Representative Galvin, we'll provide the committee. We have an early learning report. It was just handed to me. So I'll briefly go over the details, but then we'll follow up and you can have all of the details. But just for the record, there, like with the pre-kindergarten grants, in 2023, there's 674 students being served with about $5.7 million. With parents as teachers, it's 123 students with $474,700 as an example. But we'll make sure you get this full report, and that way you can get all the details.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, and for the record, Sabrina Javier, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Education and Early Development. As Commissioner Teschner mentioned in the previous slides, the department's total FY 2024 budget, not including federal COVID-19 relief funding, is about $1.65 billion. For these next slides, I will be breaking down that budget into the division level. So starting with slide 8, we have the Executive Administration Division. This division includes the Commissioner's Office as well as the State Board of Education. This division provides policy direction to the divisions within the department, as well as provides supports to the department stakeholders. The FY 2024 governor's budget for this division totals just under $1.5 million. Approximately $1 million of that is UGF, and the rest is interagency receipts. There are 7 full-time positions and 1 non-permanent position within this division. Next slide, slide 9. This is the Division of Finance and Support Services. This division includes school finance, school facilities, and our child nutrition programs. This is where the largest chunk of the department's funding sits, totaling just under $1.4 billion. There are 22 full-time positions in this division. The school finance section administers the foundation formula and the pupil transportation funding, and also provides financial support to school district business offices. The school facilities section oversees the school capital projects and administers the major maintenance and school construction grant programs. And then we also have the child nutrition section, which of course administers the child nutrition programs that most school districts participate in. This includes the National School Lunch Program, the School Breakfast Program, and the Summer Food Service Program, just to name a few. As you can see, a majority of the UGF, shown in the blue section of this bar graph, is allocated to the foundation and pupil transportation programs that go out the door to our school districts. The gray section of the bar chart represents the federal receipts, which is mostly awarded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as pass-through funds for our child nutrition programs. And then the small orange section of the chart, or the other funds, which equates to about $32.7 million, is the federal impact aid revenue. The public school trust fund. I'm sorry, the $32 million is the public school trust fund.
All right, we have Representative Hannon followed by Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, and I'm not sure it's on here with your correction. Will you make impact aid? Tell me what that entails.
Do I do it? Okay. For the record, Heidi Teschner, through the Chair, Representative Hannon. So this $20 million that's represented on this slide, this represents what the department applies for on behalf of three military bases and Mount Edgecombe High School only. The number I provided to Representative Kronk earlier in the presentation is the amount between $70 and $80 million on average is what the department applies towards the foundation funding formula to determine how much state aid that the department pays to school districts. So districts apply directly. Most school districts apply directly, but we have an agreement to apply on behalf of the three military bases and Mount Edgecombe. So that's Kodiak, Anchorage, and Fairbanks.
One follow-up. Just, I think I understand what impact aid is, so I'm looking for the broader definition. It's about federal non-taxable lands within a district's boundaries. Is that?
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, yes, and then there's aspects of it that take into account sped students, but in a general, then yeah, I would say yes, you're accurate.
Thank you.
All right, we have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, I'm just looking again, when I go back to slide 6 under UGF, you have the 1.285331 that represents the UGF going into the BSA, but I think there was some more there. But then on this next page, it says, or on the page we're looking at now, on number 9, on page 9, Foundation Program 1.140791. So can you tell me what's in the difference between those two figures on those two different pages?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, so that these numbers, the whole UGF column,
yeah,
on this slide is included in that $1.28 billion that's shown on slide 6. So this breaks it down even further so you can see exactly which components contribute to the unrestricted general fund total.
Okay.
So now we're drilling down through the Chair. We're drilling down from the bigger number on slide 6 down to the individual components.
Okay. But just last question. I mean, it's obviously, you know, the BSA is going to be a big topic here throughout this whole session. So that's kind of why I'm trying to pin it down. But even though you say that reflects, those are still two different numbers, significantly a little bit different numbers that we're talking about. You're talking about 1229824 versus on the previous page, you're talking about 1291. I mean, it's a little different anyway. So can you tell me about, it doesn't all quite match up.
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, I think as we go through the rest of the slides, mm-hmm, and you add up all of the unrestricted general fund columns, you'll see it should add up to what's shown on the total on slide 6. So
thank
there's
you.
Multiple.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Thank you. Next is Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Court Chair Johnson. Through the Chair, just a process question or observation. Like on page 6, we've got 2020 actuals, 23 management, and 24 budget, amended budget. Just having totals in those columns from 2022, 2023, so I wouldn't have to get up here with my calculator and see it. That way I can kind of have more of a quicker
observation, I can see where the budget is going, you know, up or going down, or you know, just that. So that would be helpful. Thank you.
We can make that change. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to slide number 10. And again, for the record, Sabrina Javier, Administrative Services Director. Slide number 10 is the Division of Administrative Services. This division provides internal department services such as accounting, budget, IT, human resources, procurement, and also grants administration to support the entire department. The budget components in this division are the administrative services, information services, and also our facilities rent component. The total FY24 budget totals $6.5 million for this division, and there are 17 full-time positions within this division. The one significant budget change in this division that you'll see is a $2 million request for interagency receipt authority. So you'll see that jump from FY23 management plan, to FY24 governor amended in the orange. This will allow the division to have a more consistent method for allocating the chargebacks that we receive from the Department of Administration, such as from the Office of Information Technology, Shared Services of Alaska, Personnel Labor Relations, and the services provided by the Division of Finance. Since not all of these services use the same rate methodology, it's the department's intention to streamline the methodology for all of these expenditures that we receive from them. So by collecting the funds to streamline the rate methodology, since not all of these services use the same rate methodology, it's the department's intention to streamline the methodology for all of those expenditures, collect the funds from each of the divisions, and pay it out of this appropriation. There's no budgetary impact to the department, and it just simply helps us manage and track our chargeback costs more efficiently. Okay, moving on to slide number 11, the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. This division is comprised of the early learning coordination, the pre-kindergarten grants, the student school achievement, and the teacher certification components. The total FY24 budget for this division, not including the estimated federal COVID-19 carry forward, is approximately $201.4 million. There are 68 full-time positions and 5 non-permanent positions budgeted for FY24 in this division. This division has received a substantial amount of federal COVID-19 relief funds from the U.S. Department of Education from all 3 acts that were implemented. And those funds are housed within this division. The green section of the bar chart will show you how much was spent in FY22, what is budgeted for this current fiscal year, and as Commissioner Teschner mentioned earlier, what our estimated carry forward amount will be.
Are we finished with this slide?
One moment. If you
have questions at the end of the slide.
Okay. And if you haven't already, I highly encourage you to check out our department's COVID-19 funding dashboard on our website. This allows you to drill down the funding down to the school district level and the grantee level on how much they've been awarded and how much they've spent. And I apologize, we don't have that link on our slide here, but you can easily navigate it through our website.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. I just wanted to check in. I think you mentioned 68 positions for this division.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, and I would like to know how many of those positions are early learning coordination and how many of those positions are pre-K. And both of those, I assume, are the full extent of early learning.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, for the record, Heidi Teschner. Currently, there's actually no positions in the pre-kindergarten grants component, so there's no positions there. The staff that support that are in the early learning coordination. And I want to say that we just added 3 positions to the Alaska Reads Act. So
we added new positions.
So there was two positions there. We added three more. I believe there's five, but we can verify that. I don't have that in front of me.
Follow up. Just to clarify then, of the 68 positions for early learning, the 3 to 5-year-olds were looking at less than 10 or roughly around 5 positions.
Through the chair is correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Commissioner, tell us about the $312 million in federal COVID money. Are there two things that just sort of intuitively jump to mind? The first is, why does it keep coming and what is it for?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So the federal COVID relief funding was appropriated by the federal U.S. Department of Education, and this encompasses the the CARES Act, the Corona, I'm not going to say the acronym because I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's the CARES Act, there's the CERSA Act, and then the ARP Act. And so this encompasses all of that funding. It was provided to states in response to provide support in response to the COVID, for response to the COVID-19 pandemic to help with learning loss and getting the protective gear needed and just anything in response to it. It was a wide variety of allowable expenditures in it. Under the ARP Act, the American Rescue Plan, there was a 20% requirement that districts had to spend that on learning loss. And so it was just the U.S. Department of Education and the federal government's response to the federal 19 pandemic and extra additional support for school districts and other grantees.
Follow up.
I think an important question, Commissioner, would be, can a district that receives its slice of the federal COVID money use it in the way they would use the BSA dollars they receive?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, there was a lot of flexibility and they could use it at their discretion. The department did have to review and approve their budgets and how they were going to spend the money, but it was a very, very wide flexibility of how the federal government allowed that funding to be spent.
Okay, just quick follow-up.
You're
speaking through the chair a little bit in the past tense, but this is FY24 dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this is the carryover money that the districts haven't, that we anticipate. I don't believe it's going to be quite the $312 million, but this is what we anticipate could be carried forward into fiscal year 2024. So districts have already been appropriated. They already know what their allocation is under each of the three acts that passed. The CARES Act has closed this past September. The CERSA Act, they have until September of 23 to spend that down. And then the ARP funding they have until September of 24. So this is just them, districts still utilizing how they're a long-term range of how they're going to spend the money. So not all of them have allocated it yet. And that's our COVID dashboard provides a lot more of that information that's readily available. But it's a long-term range, so they're forward planning of how they're going to spend the money.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair. So just for clarification, that 312 expires September of this year or next year?
Through the Chair, Representative Cologne, there's a portion of it will expire in September of 23 and another portion will expire in September of 24. I don't have the breakdown in front of me, but it's multiple years. And they have, just to also clarify, we provide an allocation to school districts. They don't get the money up front. They have to provide a budget, and they submit a request for reimbursement. So we only pay them for what they've actually expended.
Good. Thank you.
Question? Representative Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. So for clarification again, I see that the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence has been largely funded with COVID funds. A large portion of those funds have, or support that particular branch of DEED. They're going to go away someday. So what kind of problems does that bring the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence when that money goes away?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So this funding primarily is passed through grants out the door. So we keep very little internally for daily operations. We have hired three non-perm positions to help support the additional work
that came with COVID, the COVID funding, the federal reporting, the additional applications with school districts, reviewing all of that. Those positions will expire when the funding expires. But we have not added a lot of any long-term range expenditures that will require ongoing support from the state. We try to make sure we're spending the money on one-time expenditures at the state level that so we can sustain it long-term, the work that we're doing.
Last
follow-up.
So if I hear you correctly, then there's not going to be an impact to pre-kindergarten grants, student and school achievement, teachers, well, teacher certification doesn't use any of it anyway. None of that will be impacted, even though it seems like they make up a large portion of that budget.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the daily work that we, the funding that you see in the unrestricted, the first four columns, that's pretty much the work that's ongoing with the department. The COVID money was additional work added on. And so everything else will remain continuing as going when the federal COVID money expires. Does that help?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So if I'm hearing you correctly, the $312 million, just to be extra repetitive, but I want to make sure that we're all clear on this, it can be used, it is a pass-through mostly to districts. It's in retrospect. They may use it, as I understand, to cover anything related to catching students up, so that's very general. And as I've heard from districts, some of them are using it simply to do the work at hand, that they are using it as a fill-in when they've run out of reserves. Is that something that you've heard as well?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes. We, when reviewing their request for reimbursements, if we saw something, because this is past tense, because we've already reviewed budgets, but if we saw something that was going to be an ongoing expenditure, we would caution them not to do that. We even, the department provided a memo to school districts, caution of them of using this one-time money for ongoing expenditures. The department can't deny those ongoing that use of it because it was an allowable use from the federal government, but we could caution them against it. It was ultimately their decision of how to spend the money.
Chair Jones. Oh. Representative Galvin, and then we'll move on.
Hannon.
I'm sorry, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Ms. Teschner, my question is not about COVID money, but could you give me a quick description of the work of the student and school achievement in the kinds of supports they do for standards, assessment, and accountability on a regular basis?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask Director McKenzie to come up here and provide you with a more detailed answer than I probably can. Or Deb Riddle, our Division Operations Manager with the Division of Innovation and Education as well.
Thank you, through the chair. For the record, my name is Deborah Riddle, and I'm the Division Operations Manager for Innovation and Education Excellence. The Division of Innovation and Education Excellence has 9 teams, which covers assessments, data and reporting, the early learning, the federal programs. I'm going to try not to forget one. Special education. School improvement and the reading the team that runs the Reads Act. And so on a day-to-day basis, we collaborate, we provide supports. The majority of the federal money goes through grants out to districts. We have program managers who manage those grants and those programs through the department. We provide supports. Some of the programs like the academic support team and the school improvement team provide supports to help those struggling districts. The special education team manages all the special education programs and makes sure that all of those students are served the way that they need to be. The early education program manages, works with, we have one person who works with the Head Start folks, and then we have a person who works with special education 619 preschool as well as supporting the pre-kindergarten grants. And we've just just today found out that we have an administrator for that team for the READS Act, so that's kind of exciting news. But mostly it's supporting districts in moving their programs forward and providing the support and resources and as they need it, and then helping them. It's high level. We're not in the weeds, but we do provide that support and the guidance and checking for allowability to make sure that everybody stays kind of on the up and up, and we don't run into issues later on. So,
all right. Thank you
very much.
Okay, and for the record, again, Sabrina Javier, just to finish off this. Slide number 11, COVID funds aside, the majority of the division's budget is federal receipts. This is mostly going to be the pass-through title funding to school districts from the U.S. Department of Education. The federal increase you see from FY23 to FY24 is our governor's amended request of $22.3 million of federal receipt authority in order to address the increased title awards from the U.S. Department of Education. The proposed FY24 UGF for this division is approximately $30 million. The significant changes in FY24 for UGF is mainly the second year implementation of the Alaska READS Act that was passed last session, so that's about $6.3 million, and then also a temporary increase for the pre-kindergarten grants totaling $2.5 million. Also for fiscal year 2024, you'll see that we're requesting to consolidate the state system of support component into the student and school achievement component. This is why you won't see the state system of support component listed here. Both components perform work that overlap, and so we felt it was wise to consolidate the two for efficiencies. Moving on to slide number 12, the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. This budget is comprised of the library operations, museum operations, archives, online with libraries, live homework help, broadband assistance grants, and the Andrew P. Kashevaroff facilities maintenance components. The Andrew P. Kashevaroff building here in Juneau houses the Alaska State Archives, the State Library, as well as our Alaska State Museum. We also have the Sheldon Jackson Museum in Sitka, Alaska, as well. Their total operating budget for FY24 is approximately $18.26 million. This division has 49 full-time positions and one non-permanent position, and the division's budget has pretty much remained flat, and they don't have a proposed FY24 budget request in this division.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. You mentioned that this component has OWL funding. There's something similar to it, or it's often discussed in the same sentence, called SLED. The legislature has repeatedly appropriated money, particularly at the request of state librarians who care a lot about the program, and the governor has repeatedly, I think, vetoed that. Where are we on SLED funding?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, and I might call a lifeline, Dr. Amy Chan, up to answer.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Dr. Amy Phillips Chan, Division Director of Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So the SLED database is actually part of our IMLS funding that's received every year. It's part of a interlibrary cooperation grant that is the competitive grant program. It's been around since the 1980s. And the SLED database is run by the Alaska Library Network, which applies for that grant every year.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. These librarians I meet with annually are super smart, and they tell me this money is not there. It's been vetoed, or at least not supplemented in years. So I'm taking my marching orders from Steve Rollins, who's the head librarian at UAA, and I don't think he's wrong about that. But you seem to suggest it's there.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Yes, I'm just looking at my FY23. Funding and that amount, if you give me just 1 second, I will find how much that was. So for FY23, the SLED databases received $500,351. And grant monies through the IMLS Interlibrary Cooperation Grant Program.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. My question is about the broadband assistance grants, and I am just curious. My presumption is we've been using that to support school districts who have limited broadband, and with the new broadband office and broadband money, is this grant program intersecting with them, providing data? Will it go away in 5 years when we've stood up state-of-the-art, super-fast broadband to every corner in Alaska?
For the record, Heidi Teschner, through the chair, Representative Hannon. So we are still working. So far, this is a standalone grant separate from that broadband office. So we haven't had conversations yet with them. We have a department representative on that, part of that group, but we haven't had conversations yet about whether this will morph into that, merge into that, or if this program will continue long-term. We haven't had those conversations, so we're just assuming as long as the statute stays in place, this program will continue.
One quick follow-up of just...
One quick follow-up, and then we're going to go ahead and try to finish up this slide, and then we'll save our questions until the end of and take questions at the end of each slide so we're not separating out our presentation.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So I just want to make sure and footnote that I really encourage the department to be speaking directly because the broadband office is floating these maps of places with low or underserved communities and... the future of how the federal money is going to distribute depends on us verifying that the service in a variety of locations is not adequate. And here's a program that we've been running to underwrite that and say it's really not adequate to do school. And since those maps are being developed right now, making sure that these grantees are represented in that is really important for that person to do, not just attend those meetings, but actively say, here's where we've been given grants because we know that they don't have services.
Okay. Moving on to slide number 13, the Professional Teaching Practices Commission. The commission has the responsibility and the power to discipline members of the teaching profession and may issue reprimands, suspensions, and revocations of educators' certificates. The commission has one full-time employee, the executive director, who works for the nine-member commission. The commission is made up of five teachers, one superintendent, one principal, one university representative, and one department representative. The total proposed budget for the commission for FY24 is $268,000, with a request for a fund change of $100,000 from general fund program receipts to UGF. The commission is funded from teacher certification fees under the teacher certification component. However, we are anticipating that teacher certification revenue won't be enough to cover both the teacher certification component and the professional teaching practices component. This is mainly because we haven't increased the cost of teacher certification fees since, I believe, fiscal year 2016 to meet the increasing operational costs in both components. So when you take into effect regular salary increases, increased chargeback costs, and other increased costs, this leaves a shortfall in the budget. So if we don't have the revenue, we can't pay our bills. So with this fund change, this will allow both teacher certification and the teaching commission to continue operations without having to increase fees for educators. The commission also, just for your awareness, has a supplemental request totaling $105,000 to address our increased administrative hearing and legal services costs for this year, for FY23. Currently, the commission has been assigned four administrative law judges in response to four administrative hearing requests. This is a unique situation that the commission doesn't experience every year. The last hearing we had was in 2018, so it's sort of difficult to budget for these requests. Okay, moving on to slide number 14, the Alaska State Council on the Arts. They represent, support, and advance the creative endeavors of individuals, organizations, and agencies throughout Alaska. They are a public corporation and provide a wide range of services and programs to Alaskans.
Their FY24 budget totals approximately $4.4 million, and they have 5 full-time positions and 1 non-permanent position. The Arts Council is mostly funded by other funds. This is the orange section in the chart. In this case, this would be statutory designated program receipts. This is the funding that the Arts Council receives from the Rasmussen Foundation and the Margaret A. Cargill Philanthropies. The next largest funding source is federal receipts, which is the funding that the council receives from the National Endowment of the Arts, followed by the UGF section in blue, which is the general fund match requirement for the Endowment of the Arts. The Arts Council did also receive federal COVID-19 funding, as you can see there, but those funds do expire at the end of this fiscal year. The Arts Council has 2 requests in the FY24 governor's budget. The first one is for $20,000 in the Arts in Public Places funding. The Arts in Public Places Fund are receipts collected under the authority of Alaska Statute 44.27.060, which places 1% of the construction costs of a building or facility into the fund. Currently, the council has authority to spend up to $30,000 of that fund, but this one-time increase would bring it up to $50,000 so that the council can digitize inventory and track their art bank collection and allow borrowers to view and request the available artwork online. And the next request is for $5,000 in unrestricted general funds in response to the passage of Senate Bill 71 last year. This was for a special vehicle registration plate celebrating the arts. The Arts Council will use the receipts from the license plates to sustain the program and cover the costs for the artist's design fee, preparation for production, and educational materials about the program. Okay, moving on to slide 15. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, their mission is to promote access to and success in education and career training beyond high school. Their budget is comprised of the Alaska Performance Scholarship Award, the Alaska Education Grants, loan servicing, program administration and operations, and also the WAMI Medical Education Program. The Commission on Post-Secondary Education has 53 full-time positions and 1 non-permanent position budgeted for FY24. Their FY24 budget is approximately $43.3 million. The biggest budgetary change that you'll see from FY23 to FY24 is a fund change of approximately $21.4 million from UGF to DGF, which in this case would be the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. This current fiscal year, the Alaska Performance Scholarship, Alaska Education Grants, WAMI Medical Education Program, and some of the program administration and operations for ACPE are being funded out of UGF. Additionally, there is an increase of $1,647,500 in the Higher Education Investment Funds to continue the WAMI Medical Education Program expansion from 20 to 30 seats for Alaskan students. This was initially added to the budget last session as a multi-year appropriation, but after further discussions with the University of Alaska Anchorage and the University of Washington School of Medicine, it was determined that UAA needed to expand their facilities to meet this need. So this request will cover the additional costs associated with the University of Washington School of Medicine's contract. And moving on to slide 16, these are just some of bullet points of some of our more high-level budget changes. I have mentioned a few of these in previous slides, but if the committee has any questions on any of these, I'd be happy to answer.
And for the record, Heidi Teschner, Acting Commissioner. So for the next 3 slides, they just provide some historical information for you, and it's just being provided as reference. So we have a chart on the history from 1999 through fiscal year 2024, the base student allocation, the BSA funding, how much the BSA has been, and then an inflation chart, and it also includes when there was outside the funding formula appropriated. So as mentioned earlier, in fiscal year 2023, there was $57 million that was funded outside of the formula that what was distributed to grants based on adjusted average daily memberships. This is just for your reference. Slide 19 provides the state aid total.
We have a question from Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Teschner. Curious if you could maybe discuss where the state is at in making progress on our state tribal education compacting initiatives that we've been talking about in recent years. Didn't see any information about that in our slide deck, and wondered if you could speak to that. Thank you.
Absolutely, through the chair, Representative Stapp. So they, at our March 17th meeting, the State Board of Education will select up to five tribes from Senate Bill 34. The State Board has the can work with up to five tribes to go through that negotiation process. So on March 16th, they will make their final decision on which tribes that they will select. We did an RFA, and five tribes did submit applications. So whether they'll select all five or a number or up to those five, we'll know in a couple weeks. Following that, in April, we'll have a kickoff meeting with the tribes just to kind of start the process, and then really hit the ground running in May, figuring out what the negotiation process between who's going to do what. So we have a timeline over the next year, or not the next year, it's really more like 10 months. There's going to be a report provided to the legislature in January of 24 that will summarize the negotiation process with potential legislation of what tribal education compacting would look like, and then that would go through the legislative process. So we are just kicking that off soon in April of what the next steps will be.
And follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the five tribes that basically did the RSA. You can pick up to five. I'm just curious, can you tell us who those five tribes are right now, or do we have to wait till March to find out?
Representative Stapp, we have to wait until just a couple more weeks. I don't have them off the top of my head anyway, so I couldn't tell you that today. But in a couple weeks, we'll be able to, just like it's like 2 or 3 weeks away.
Very good. Representative Galvin, followed by Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. And looking at slide 18, I see what it looks to me like a visual for the BSA, the amount of BSA. And I wondered if in other departments, we've seen a lot of the overviews, and we've been able to see their spend versus the costs of what they're doing. And I wondered if you had any visual representation of the change of costs of educating folks as opposed to the BSA. In other words, something with regard to the inflationary costs.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we do have slide 19, which shows the historical of what has been paid out as state aid. None of the, I just provided the three charts as some history in reference to the committee. We do have on our website budget and actual reporting that provides what districts have actually spent their funding on in their operating fund as well as in some special revenue funds. I don't have that in the packet today.
Follow up? I guess what I was wondering about is some sort of reflection I understand you have what districts are spending their money on. I wondered if it would be helpful for us to understand the various cost changes. For example, we know that they're changing up their programs and reducing numbers of people and things like that, but just a sense of what inflation or any sort of measurement of inflation as compared to the dollars spent in education.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we can see what we can follow up and provide the committee with to help answer that question.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay, I think we have Representative Ortiz in the queue as well. So let's go ahead and we'll start with it. Representative Ortiz, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. If we could go back to slide 16. The Alaska Reads Act, second year implementation, $6.3 million going towards that, the three full-time positions. So the question is, I've been hearing a lot of concern from around the state about the Reads Act. Not that it's not a good act, but that it's significantly underfunded. What would you say about that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I would say, and I might call on a lifeline, but I would say that what is being asked for in the Reads Act is best practice, and districts should be doing that already. We do recognize that it's for those that for those districts that have a number of their students that are not proficient in reading, it's going to be a large amount of work in the beginning, especially with the individual reading plans and the extra supports needed based on the Reads Act. There was the $30 BSA increase that was included in the budget for 24. Yes, that's a small token, but that was put in there to help support the implementation at the district level for the implementation of this act.
Follow-up?
Enough right now. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Commissioner, I think if I asked our legislative finance team to inflation adjust the FY17 numbers, I think they'd tell me that we're short in the range of $260 million. So that if FY17 was smart and sensible, and I understand we could have that debate, that we're short of smart and sensible by $260 million. Has there ever been a time in history, to your knowledge, where there's been that sort of gap in funding?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, not to my knowledge.
Follow-up. Should the state, to your knowledge, to the extent you've been exposed to this sort of discussion, be worried about litigation concerning our duty to fully fund public schools?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think we recognize that the base student allocation hasn't kept up with inflation. We recognize that that needs to be addressed. Whether or not we are adequately funding our schools, that's a policy call we need to figure out based on the data that we have and the students that we're serving. So, that's the conversation we need to figure out.
Thank you.
Well, the good thing is that that's up for us to grapple with, and as policymakers, that's our job to figure out. So, but we appreciate the question. I'm not sure who was next was in the queue. I believe maybe we didn't have anyone. So, very good.
No, sure. It's not a question, it's a comment. I asked my staff to follow up with the university's top librarian at the Anchorage campus, and he reports that SLED definitely does not have funding, that OWL and Live Homework Help do, but that the governor vetoed the SLED funding. And I just wanted the committee to be aware of at least this librarian's position on that.
Very good. And we do appreciate having the department here with us today. We do have another presentation scheduled for us in the committee, so we appreciate hearing from you, and as always, thank you very much. Next up we have I'm going to go ahead and take a brief at ease while we just kind of change up things for our next presentation from Mr. Painter on the BSA formula. House Finance back on the record. Next up on the agenda, we have a history of the base student allocation formula presented by Alexi Painter, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. Director Painter, will you please come forward, place yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Alexi Painter, I'm the Director of the Legislative Finance Division. So I'll be presenting an overview of a little broader than just the base student allocation. We'll look at funding sources for school districts broadly, who pays for school district budgets, talk about direct sources of funding and then indirect sources, and we'll compare a little bit to funding in other states. Then we'll get into the state formula funding history, including the impact of the factors and how that's changed over time. And then at the end, we'll have a slide about some funding levers for the legislature. So in FY23, this graph just shows the school district budgeted revenue, and this is from Department of Education's reports by payer. It's the largest chunk of revenue. 63% of their revenue comes from the state, 25% comes from local governments, 11% comes from the federal government, and that includes the federal E-rate funding that sometimes can go in a few different categories. And then about 1% is other funding. That includes tuition and investment returns. So the vast majority of the state of the funding here is from the state, with the locals making up the second largest contribution. Going on to slide 4, showing the sources of funding. The largest source of funding is the foundation program of about $1.2 billion. That is just over half of the funding. The local amounts that make up 25% here are 23%. So this is where we get into a bit of the direct versus indirect. This graph includes some of the indirect funding that the state pays towards school districts. And so you can see that there's a lot of different funding sources that are going to districts. There's the direct foundation program, the pupil transportation program. There's the additional foundation funding that was paid out in the current fiscal year, deductible federal impact aid that goes again to the foundation formula, local contributions, federal funding, and then TERS and some PERS payments on behalf of school districts. So the state pays everything over the cap of 12.5% for school districts. That funding does not show up in the classroom, but the state paying that prevents that amount from being a cost that the districts would have to pay. So it's a cost that we're paying on behalf of the districts, but if you look at the district revenue on that last slide, it doesn't show up as district revenue because it goes directly to the retirement system. School debt reimbursement, similarly, is not a cost you'll see in school district budgets. We're reimbursing municipalities for their share of debt service on school projects. So in our municipal school districts, that those capital projects are paid for by the local governments, and then through the school debt reimbursement program, the state will reimburse a share of that. So again, you don't see that in the district revenue because that money is going to the local governments, but it's part of the state's contribution to education funding. Same with the REAA funding, that's the regional education attendance area funding to that formula. That then goes for rural school construction and major maintenance. Again, doesn't show up directly in the classroom, but is funding the state is paying for local projects.
All right. We have Representative Plum, followed by Representative Martinez.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair. Hi, thanks for being here. So where's the public school fund trust funding in the pie?
Through the Chair, Representative Plum, that shows up in the foundation program. Currently, all of the public school trust funds are used as one of the state sources of money for the foundation program.
Can I have a follow-up? So the trust fund sounds like a lot of limitations on how much can be withdrawn. Do you know what the balance of that fund is right now about?
Through the Chair, Rep. Colum, I don't remember the exact balance. It's in the $600 to $700 million range. I'm not sure how their investments have been doing lately, whether it's on the upper range or not.
Okay.
But somewhere in that range.
Thank you.
And Representative Marquez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. Mr. Painter, under school debt reimbursement, am I correct in understanding that's optional for the state to fund that versus mandatory?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that is subject to appropriation. So while the state has agreed through statutes to take on that debt, it's subject to appropriation by the legislature each year.
Follow-up?
Have we ever not funded school debt reimbursement under the statutory guidelines?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. We did not fully fund it in FY 17, 20, 21, or initially in FY 22. Then in the FY 22 supplemental, the state repaid those past unfunded amounts from those years. Prior to that period, so districts have now been reimbursed, although obviously they were out of funds at the time. There were some other periods, I think, in the 90s and earlier when we did not fully pay the 100% as well.
Last
what follow-up?
And so, again, more for the listening public, while it's legislative appropriation, the administration, whatever administration is in power, has the ability to also veto that appropriation, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. Like in any appropriation, the executive branch can veto that.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Director Painter. A quick thought, based on, again, Rep. Ortiz's line of questioning. School bond debt reimbursement still under, well, new things are under the moratorium. Is there any issue with the state effectively paying the existing bond debt while maintaining the moratorium?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So the moratorium to, I guess for the public, began in 2015, is currently scheduled to end in 2025, and that's a moratorium on new debt. So the debt we're paying is debt that was incurred before the moratorium. From district standpoint or from municipalities, I'm sure they would prefer to keep being reimbursed for that debt they already incurred. But that just means that they can't incur new debt under the program. If they incur new debt, the state would not kick in a share. If they hold the election after July 1st of 2025, they would be entitled to a share of state reimbursement at that point.
Thank you.
All right, very good.
All right, going on to just an explanation of direct versus indirect sources. I kind of talked about this, but just to put a finer point in this. So school districts receive direct funding through the state foundation and pupil transportation formulas, through federal impact aid and federal title programs, municipal contributions, and E-rate funding. They also receive indirect funding that does not show up in their revenue reports, but is spent by the state on their behalf. That includes PERS and TERS funding, school debt reimbursement, school construction, and major maintenance funding, including through the REAA fund. Sometimes when we're looking at national comparisons, we look at the Census Bureau's school finance data. It does include PERS and TERS funding, but not the other indirect sources. So as we look at these various ways to slice the funding, you'll notice just different totals that don't always add up to the same thing. Like on the first and second slide, they don't add up the same. That's because one has indirect funding, one doesn't. Then when we look at the Census Bureau numbers, again, they won't add up to the same thing. It's because it includes some of our indirect sources, but not all. So don't get alarmed if none of the numbers in this presentation don't add up. We're not always comparing the exact same things here. Most of this presentation will talk just about the foundation and pupil transportation formulas and municipal contributions. We won't talk about those other sources that were on that last slide. Going on to slide six, so this is a national comparison. This is from the Census Bureau. FY 20 is the last complete year. There's only, I think, 42 states so far reported for FY 21. And this sorts the district or the states by per pupil funding of state funds only. So by state funds only, Alaska ranks fourth in the nation, or did in FY 20. But as you can see, that's not necessarily a particularly logical way to sort the bars. The total funding bars don't really line up. So sometimes you'll hear the state spends more on education than any other state or is in the top few. It's true that the state share was fourth in FY 20, although I think if we did an FY 23 number, we'd be a bit lower based on FY 21. We're a little bit lower even without all the states in there. So if you look at all funds here on slide 7, you can see that in all funds we actually rank 11th rather than 4th. And the reason for that difference is that Alaska is 9th nationally in the proportion of state of funds that come from the state government. So while we have an unusually large amount of federal funding, we also have a more state-heavy versus municipal-heavy education formula. The state has chosen to take on the majority of that funding, whereas in many states there's more of a mix. So, sorry, I'm moving through slides fast, but I'm happy to go back if there are questions. So our formula in FY20 was funded about 64% from the state government compared to the national median, which is about 48%, so about 50-50. So we have a more state-heavy system. That's not to say that our system is more expensive. It just means that when you're doing a comparison of state funds only, it makes Alaska look more expensive than if you look at all funds. And then ICER, which at the University of Alaska Anchorage, the Institute of Social and Economic Research, has done comparisons in the past that adjust for cost of living differentials. That's their work, so I'm not going to present it. But if you're interested in that work, they have published those if you want to look at more cross-state comparisons.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. If you went back one slide when you're talking about the state versus comparing Alaska to other states for all funding, I guess I'm curious as to whether you've done any analysis between our municipal school districts and REAAs, because, of course, when we're looking at them all together, but, you know, certainly my impression, and I think we have data from OMB that shows in other states, is that you've got counties contributing to local governments, and I'm not actually advocating for us to lower fund, but have we accounted for what the state funds in a city school district compared to other city school districts in other states versus our rural school district and counties that may contribute?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so I've not tried to like look at this comparison of if we just looked at municipal school districts, so I can't speak to that. That would probably be a factor here in why we're relatively state heavy, is that there are districts that don't contribute. I have done analysis in the past that's very speculative, so it's difficult to get numbers on, but whether our net costs are actually higher or lower due to the lack of municipal school districts. So if every area in the state organized, there would be a few results to that that would impact the state. So one, we would have to pick up the municipalities would have a local contribution in those areas. However, some of those areas that have significant oil and gas property, currently because of the way the tax is structured, the municipal tax, in those unorganized areas, the entire property tax goes to the state. If those areas organized, those municipalities could levy a tax on that property that would be deducted from the state tax. And so that would be a revenue reduction to the state. So there's certain areas of the state that if they had a local government would undoubtedly the state would lose money, even though we would get a municipal contribution from those areas. It wouldn't result in the net benefit to the state necessarily, because the local government would gain that tax revenue, depending on their tax rates. Another factor is in the deductible impact aid. So Alaska, one of the reasons we're high on the federal number here relatively is that we have a lot of federal impact aid for military activity and then Alaska Native tribal lands. So tribal lands that are not taxed because they're tribal lands, the federal government will pay us impact aid because we're not allowed to tax those tribes. And in municipal school districts, the deductible portion of that impact aid is multiplied by a factor relating to the local effort, taxing effort. So essentially, about half, we only get to deduct about half of the 90% of deductible impact aid, to put a lot of numbers together. In REAAs that have no local effort, we get to deduct that entire 90%. So for some of these districts that have significant amounts of local impact aid, the amount the state deducts would go down by so much that it would outweigh any local contribution because their most valuable land is often non-taxable because it's tribal land. So it's a very long-winded answer to your question, but I think just trying to get across that there's a lot of factors here about whether our system is really results in the state cost being net, on net higher than if we had organized areas. I think it's ambiguous at best.
Thank you.
Okay, I hope I didn't divert too much into into that answer. So we'll go on to slide 8A. Sorry, this one was added late. So this is, before we go into the actual foundation formula, the comparisons, I'll just explain what how the formula works briefly. So we start with the average daily membership. That's the student count that's taken in districts on a 20-day period ending the last Friday in October. It's often called the October student count, but based on the way that works out, sometimes it starts in September. Then we take the ADM, that average daily membership, and adjust it by a number of factors to get the adjusted average daily membership. So those factors, to get to that adjusted average daily membership, first we remove all of the correspondent students. Those non-brick and mortar students do not get all the other multipliers. Instead, they all count as 0.9 average daily membership. So they don't get the full funding of a brick and mortar student or the multipliers. The non-correspondent student count is then multiplied by all of these factors. So the first is the school size factor. That school size table has not changed since the original formula was enacted in 1998. It provides more funds per student for districts with smaller schools, and it's calculated on a per school basis. The district values range from 1.12 in Anchorage, meaning that after the school size factor, that one student becomes 1.12 students in Anchorage, to 2.83 in Pelican, which is a district that has one school with 16 students. That has a very high school size factor, and as a result, the one student there becomes 2.83 students after that adjustment. The next adjustment is the district cost factor, which adjusts for cost differentials between districts. The values range from 1 in Anchorage, that's the base, and then the high is Yukon Flats at 2.116. And I'll talk a little more about school district cost factors in a later slide. Next is the special needs factor, which is a block grant. So it's not based on the actual number of special needs students. It's just a block grant that multiplies every district's ADM by 1.2. So it's basically a 20% block grant for special needs funding. It doesn't vary district by district. The next factor is also a block grant. It's the career and technical education factor, which is 1.015 or 1.5%. And then there's the special education intensive factors. So there's for the students that are identified by districts as intensive special education students rather than just other special needs students, they receive 13 times the ADM for those students. So they're kind of those particular students are counted and then given 13 times the funding. So then when you add this all back up, you get to the adjusted average daily membership. That is then multiplied by the base student allocation to get basic need. So basic need is what our foundation formula results in. It's the base student allocation is often conflated with the entire formula. Basic need is really the amount we get to. The state aid is actually calculated by taking basic need, subtracting out the required local contribution, subtracting out the deductible state federal impact aid, and then you get state aid of everything on top. So really, those two come first, and then state aid for everything above. And I know a lot of information on the slide, so I'll pause for questions here.
Is there anywhere that this is actually written out in a formula type of? I mean, you don't have one on your slide where it's actually just written out in a formula structure, so we can see.
Chair Johnson, the Department of Education has a kind of more in-depth presentation about just how this foundation formula works, and that's on their website as well. That has that. We also on our website have the Citizens Guide to the K-12 Formula that also lays it out in more depth, and I can make sure the committee has access to those as well that provide more depth on the actual mechanics of the formula.
All right. We have Representative Stapp followed by Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Director Painter. So regarding the school size factor, so is that amalgamated through the entire district, or is it actually a multiplier per individual school per student?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, it is based on per school calculations.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the director. So I am curious if anyone has ever kind of taken a, it's called an urban district, say in Anchorage or Fairbanks, and kind of looked at the amount of facilities and students enrolled in those facilities comparative to other areas, just to see, because if it were me, for example, I would try to maximize my potential revenues by kind of thinking at that. So just curious.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, you know, we, at Ledge Finance, at least we don't look at district funds that way. I would say that there's a hold harmless provision that was added by the legislature a few years ago that enables districts to consolidate schools and retain their previous school size factor declining over a few years. So they can balance that local revenue piece against the cost savings. That's been an area of controversy in Anchorage in the last few years. But that was added in order to enable districts to get the savings from consolidating schools rather than the state getting all of that savings, at least for the 3 years of the of that hold harmless provision.
One more follow-up, Madam Chair.
All of Rupert Scott.
Yeah, thanks. I'll just pass, thanks.
All right, very good. Well, we're moving on to Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, we're still on slide 88. On the special ed or sped intensive factor providing 13 times the ADM, could you kind of explain that a little bit more clearly? And it's my understanding that the federal government has something to do with added funding in that for that particular category, but I might be wrong on that.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think if we get too much depth, I'll get out of my depth and have to call in the department as a lifeline. But the federal government does have a funding piece for that, but the 13 times is really just for the state costs. There may be other federal funds available for some students. To be categorized as an intensive, the district has to certify that the student needs those services and to provide a certain level of services to that student. So it's kind of goes both ways. It comes with more funding, but they do have requirements that they get for those services. But in terms of the specifics of that, I would have to defer to the department if you have more in-depth questions.
And just last question. It'll be very quick. So to quote, qualify for that, they would need to have an IEP, is that your understanding? Or would that what they need to have is an IEP for them to qualify for that kind of level of funding?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I don't want to get out of my depth and say something I'm not sure. So I can get back to the committee or if the department wants to.
Thank you.
They probably answer.
Representative Plum, followed by Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, just to Representative Ortiz, I think with the explanation from Deed and the subcommittee that those special education is for children with pretty severe physical needs, mental needs. It's obviously they would be on an IEP, but it's for someone with really high needs that are in the school. That's all. Thank you.
Representative Hannard.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Painter, I want to go back to the school size factor. You said that was created in 1998. Did we change the school size factor for Hooper Bay last year? And is that an anomaly? They're the only one that it's changed for? Or
through the chair, Representative Hannard. So that provision was really, there's a couple of kink points in the school size factor where if a district hits one of those points, they can be at a point where they lose out on a significant amount of money because of their school size hitting that point. In Hooper Bay specifically, they had, I believe, a charter school that charter schools are treated differently. And I don't remember the specifics of that bill, but it related to a very specific situation right around one of the kink points in that line.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to touch on the one piece that you mentioned, and that is the local, I think, I'm trying to make sure I have the right way to say it, the local investment in education. I know there's a cap, and I know that several of our communities, those who do have taxation, have been putting into the cap, so to speak. I wondered if in the history of the funding, if you would share if there's been talk about raising that and what would happen if we did, what are the ramifications to the overall formula and ways that the federal government may be looking at funding the state students.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I have a slide, a few slides in about the local contribution, and I'll touch on that in more depth, and I'll make sure to address your specific question.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Mr. Painter, with this BSA, do we have an average total BSA for the state with all the factors?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, so the BSA is the same for every district. So the BSA is just a number in statute right now, 5,960 for FY24. It's multiplied by the all of these factors, and I think in a couple of slides you'll be able to see what those, where we see the kind of aggregated multipliers, what those multipliers end up being for all the districts.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Alexi, for including this slide. Much appreciated, and obviously it leads to helps us get a better understanding of everything that you're about ready to add on top of it. So thank you so much.
All right. So going on to a bit of history here. So the current formula was established in 1998 with the base student allocation and these factors. The legislature has modified the factors several times. That means that $1 in the BSA in FY99, the first year, is not equivalent to $1 in the BSA in FY23. So oftentimes you'll see graphs that show just the BSA, and we'll show one in a few slides, but that's not the entire picture because $1 in the BSA is not equivalent over time. And the same thing if you look at just state contributions over time versus the entire amount of basic need, it's not the entire picture, so it can show sometimes a misleading picture because there's other payers. So the district cost factors were the biggest thing that's changed. The original factors from adopted in 1998, were modified in 2008, that implemented a study that was commissioned by the legislature and conducted and actually presented to the legislature in 2005. It was based on data that was collected from FY2000 through 2003. Those new factors were then phased in from FY09 through FY13 and have remained ever since. So our current factors date to 20 to 25-year-old data at this point. The intensive special education factor has been increased repeatedly by the legislature. It was 5 times initially, was raised to 9 times in FY10, 11 in FY11, 13 in FY12, and has remained at 13 ever since. The career and technical education factor was added in FY15. That was not original formula. And then in FY15, the correspondence multiplier also increased from 0.8 to 0.9. On the next slide, you'll be able to see the impact of all of these factor changes on the funding. Well, not the next slide. There's a couple of slides. In a few slides, we'll be able to do that.
Chair Johnson.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm looking for, Mr. Painter, just a little more information on the district cost factors. And, you know, I make some presumptions that original study was done on cost of goods and services delivered in various areas, looking at geographic cost differentials. But can you just inform us a little bit of what other things might have been included and whether it reflects things like a school district loses a building due to a fire? It's 25-year-old data, so it's not as valid as it should be. But just so I can understand what that original study entailed.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So the study that we currently adopted in 2005 was sort of the third take at a study. There was the original study conducted by the McDowell Group that developed the original formula. There was another study that the legislature commissioned and then did not choose to implement. The department also has a requirement in statute actually to develop formula factors every 2 years. When they did that in those early years, the legislature rejected their work as well. Finally, there was the study in 2005 conducted by ICER's school finance experts there that they looked at quite a range of factors. So they looked at the biggest one is the difference in the cost of employees. They looked at it through the lens of what would you need to pay a teacher at the time in order to have an equivalent quality of educator all throughout the state. So they were looking not just at cost, but also at the desirability of districts. So that what would you need to pay to actually make sure you could have those equivalent quality educators. And again, that's based on the communities as of the early 2000s, how desirable and how expensive they were. There were also amounts for energy costs. So they were looking at actual energy costs experienced by the districts in those years. The energy costs may have changed. Their form of energy consumption in those districts may have changed. They looked at shipping costs, which obviously have changed quite a bit, as well as, I think they had like 11 factors. They have a lot of factors in there. The original study is still on education's website. If you'd like to read it, there's a lot of factors that they took into consideration based on that data at the time. But the attempt at the time was to look at all of the places districts were spending money and figure out how would costs need to be adjusted to make them equivalent across districts. So sort of a cost of living, but just looking at the expenditures that a district would have versus an individual.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Representative Galvin, followed by Representative Cologne.
Thank you, through the chair. In considering the many factors that ICER did explore, I wondered if anything pops out at you as something that one community may have changed drastically over another in the state of Alaska. I mean, we know that we have a formula in place that obviously everyone in the building is talking about needs to change in terms of the base dollar amount. But is there anything that jumps out at you as a big red flag that needs to be fixed before we just do a basic adjustment in terms of helping all districts and all students?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I think, you know, given that the study at this point, you know, was released 18 years ago, it's hard to look at it and sort of say that one thing may be wrong. I think all of it reflects a very different world. You know, it's a pre-Amazon Prime world for shipping costs. It's a world with very different energy prices and an energy mix than today. Looking at educator salaries and health insurance and all of these things, there may have been quite a bit of differences that have popped up in the last 25 years that just make it very difficult to look at, you know, any particular factor as standing out as being out of date.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So, certainly so much has changed in 15 years, and Amazon Prime may be the big headline there, but again, we all have experienced Amazon Prime in this entire state, right? And we've all experienced the changes in many of the other costs associated with education. And we've all experienced inflation and such. So I guess what I'm getting at, and knowing that particular study took so long, and my concern is that the schools presently need to be able to retain teachers and attract teachers. And so I didn't know if you didn't see any red flags about one community over another that jumped out at you, then perhaps we're able to still proceed with making sure we shore up education.
Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So I don't know if you can answer this. Maybe the commissioner can, but last year, Deed failed the disparity test, or I think it was called disparity, the 25%. So was that due to, I mean, I guess, is that a red flag that maybe the formula's off?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne. So initially we did fail, and that was because So the disparity test to back up is a test that the federal government performs to see if our districts are equalized in their funding. Mm-hmm. And so they allow us to do that on the adjusted average daily membership level. So the state foundation formula, because it's equal for every district on that, that alone we would always pass.
Okay.
The variable is local funding, and then and that's why when we get into the next slide, we'll talk about the cap. But the reason that we specifically failed was that they included the pupil transportation formula in that calculation. We have many districts that, for practical reasons, don't have a pupil transportation program. There's no reason to have a bus in these communities. And adding that in caused us to fail. The department successfully appealed and had that is now excluded again, and so we did pass the disparity test. And it really had to do with that pupil transportation piece. And I'll talk about the local funding piece, I think, on the next slide.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And I'm going to ask if we could hold our questions until the end of the presentation. We have a number of slides to go, and maybe some of the questions will be answered as we hit some of the additional slides.
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about how the state versus local contributions have changed. So 34 of Alaska's 53 school districts are in organized areas. That means that their boundaries correspond to municipal boundaries, either a city or a borough. The remaining 19 districts are regional education attendance areas, or REAAs, with no municipal government and therefore no taxing power, other than the state acting as the assembly for the unorganized borough. Municipal school districts have a required local contribution and a maximum local contribution. So initially, under our old formula and in the current one, through FY01, the required local contribution was the lower of 4 mils, or 0.4% of property value, or 45% of basic need. So for most districts, 4 mils is the amount. There's a few districts that have extremely high property values that fall under the 45% of basic need calculation. Starting in FY02, there was a provision that restricted the amount of property value increase that could be added to the local contribution each year. So only 50% of that could be added each year. The idea was to, as there were some areas of the state that were growing rapidly, to prevent those property values from resulting in much higher rapidly increasing contributions. So in FY12, the legislature stopped that practice and then fixed the contribution at 2.65 mils, which was roughly the lowest contribution at the time by any district, or still 45% of basic need. So the local contribution historically was 4 mils. Today it's 2.65 because of that declining factor over that period. Although if you actually look at the required local contribution over that entire period, it actually has increased, and in fact increased faster than the education formula has as a whole, because local property tax values have increased faster than education, than our educational formula, even though they're now paying at a lower mill rate. So, you know, when we go through some of these slides where we have the graphs, you'll see that it doesn't look like the municipal share went down, even despite going from 4 mils to 2.65, and that's because those property tax values were growing faster than those inflation adjustments or than the BSA increases. So the maximum local contribution for most districts is 23% of basic need. That's selected because the federal disparity test is based on a differential of 25% of basic need. So as long as our maximum differential or optional local amount is less than that, in theory we should pass every year, except when they throw something like the pupil transportation formula at us that was not previously in it. Passing the disparity test allows the state to deduct federal impact aid. If we did not pass the federal disparity test, then we could not deduct that federal impact aid from basic need. So this year, that's $73.3 million, that if we fail the disparity test, that means that the impact aid would still be received by the districts, but we could not deduct it from our local share. So it caused state costs to increase by $73 million. So there's sort of a policy choice there that the legislature made to cap local contributions in order to ensure that we pass the disparity test and keep state costs down, because we can then we can then deduct that federal impact date. So if we fail the disparity test and allowed, you know, districts to contribute whatever they wanted, we would end up with a much more unequalized formula. You'd end up with districts with impact aid. Those wouldn't be deducted, so those districts would get a lot more money. They would get a lot more federal money and a lot more total funding. Districts that had high tax bases would then be able to contribute a lot more because there would be no cap. And then districts that did not have a local tax base, did not have impact aid, would be no better off. The state would just be picking up their costs. So there would be a lot more unequal funding between districts if we failed that disparity test and just got rid of that cap. Getting on to slide 11, so this compares the, in blue, the average daily membership, and in red, the adjusted average daily membership from FY05 through 24. So this is the last 20 years. I selected 20 years because it's a nice round number, and also it's the amount that is on Department of Education's website for the full education formula amount. It's kind of an arbitrary figure, so if you want to see years before, we can get you that data. We just wanted to have a nice even amount to show on here. Oftentimes we show just the last 10 years, but that kind of restricts to a very specific era in Alaska's financial history, so I think it may be a little misleading. So you can see that the average daily membership has not really increased over time. In FY05, it was just under 131,000, and it's been around 130,000 ever since. So the number of students really has not changed in the last 20 years. In fact, going back further than that, since the late 90s, we've really had about the same number of students. The number of students in the AADM has increased. The biggest factor there is from 09 through 11, or through 13, as those new district cost factors came online. That increased the costs substantially per AADM. So it's important to look at this and see that difference, because again, when you look at a BSA only chart, it makes it look like funding in FY08 and FY24, you're multiplying against the same thing, but you're not. There's a significant difference from year to year. Slide 12 is a slide that I think I like and most people hate, so I apologize if you hate this one, that's fine. Ignore it. This shows the relative value of each of those factors and how that's changed over time. So this is basically saying we take one student, counting them as one, and then adding what's the impact of the various factors. And this is per non-correspondent student. So the school size factor mostly has not changed, but there's an anomaly in FY21. That's because we also have lumped in the hold harmless. In FY21, there was obviously with COVID, things changed a little bit. A lot of students went from brick-and-mortar classrooms into the correspondence programs. That triggered hold harmless provisions in many districts that result in fewer brick-and-mortar students, but this hold harmless kind of equalizing that. So you see that in FY21, there's a real spike in the school size / hold harmless multiplier, and that's because of that impact of COVID where students switched to correspondence schools. Other than that, since the school size factors have not changed in statute, that's been a relatively equal multiplier over time. The cost factor multiplier, however, has changed significantly as a result of building in those higher cost factors from FY9 through 13. So you can see that those were significantly smaller, that difference of that multiplier in 09 compared to in subsequent years after those were built in. The special needs factor is 1.2 every year, so that does not change. You can see the new career and technical education factors starting, we have an FY10. Oh, it was actually, I had an error on a previous slide. It was 0.1 starting in FY10. It increased to 0.15 in FY15. It didn't begin in FY15. I apologize, I'll restate the slide. And then finally, the special education intensives, as I mentioned, that multiplier went up several times over the 09 through 13 period. And so those orange bars increased, not just because of that higher multiplier going from 5 to 13, but also more students were counted as intensives when there were more funding available in those years. So that intensive count has gone up over time. Even with that 13 times multiplier, that intensive count has still continued to rise today. The result is that back in FY05 through 08, sort of that era before the changes, each ADM was worth about 1.6 to 1.7 AADM. Today, it's about 2.2. So the result of all of those changes in the factors is significantly more money per going out to districts per dollar in the BSA. I'm not sure if we're pausing for a question here going on.
Just a second here. Representative.
I'll be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Director Painter. So I'm just very curious. If I am a brick-and-mortar school, can I use the hold harmless to juice my own correspondence kit? So let's say I start off in the school system. I enroll in a correspondence program through my own brick-and-mortar school district. Could the school district effectively use the hold harmless to maintain the brick-and-mortar funding, even though I'm a correspondence student enrolled in my own school district?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, you could do that through the life of the hold harmless, but you can't do that repeatedly. So that did happen in some cases where students switched from brick-and-mortar to correspondence in their own district. They triggered the hold harmless and then counted as a correspondence student. So those schools did see an increase in funding. That's largely worked its way through the formula at this point because they've had that three-year hold harmless. But that first year, yes, some districts were able to get funding on both sides, essentially. But there was also a big movement from many schools that did not have a correspondence program where they just lost the students. So, you know, it sort of was a really disparate impact by district.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. Would you please, I'm just wanting to articulate the different cost multipliers that changed from 2009 to 2015, I think you said. It was related to school size factors. What other, we're not counting spec ed though, correct? And we're not counting special needs, or are we adding that factor?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, so the factors that changed, the main ones were the district cost factors from 09 through 13, and then the SPED multiplier, which went from 5 to 13 from FY 09 through 12. So if you look here, the green bars are those cost factors, mm-hmm. and you can see the 09 through 13, those increasing. Mm-hmm. And the orange is that SPED intensives, and you can see those increasing over the same period as through FY12, those multipliers went from 5 to 13.
Thank you. And follow up, if I may. And so my understanding is with regard to the special needs factor and the spec ed intensive factor, that those were to address legal challenges that the state was not doing its due diligence, if you will, and not using the proper language, I don't believe. But my understanding is that was not something that we can change back or make any changes to in retroactively to move back in that direction. So this is one of those things that we don't really have any choice about, is there?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, so other states have a variety of different methods for paying for these. It's essentially not optional to pay for them, but the method you pay for them is subject to the legislature choosing. The 13 times multiplier was selected based on districts presenting the actual cost for these students, finding that the factor they were providing at the time did not actually meet the actual cost they were facing. So it was adjusted essentially based on the feedback from districts about what costs were they experiencing and what multiplier would they need to meet those costs. It was, you know, selected by the legislature based on that feedback, not by, you know, the federal government or anything else. Different states handle it differently. There's some states that actually say that any cost over a certain dollar figure, the state will just pick up directly. Or that others say that they can submit invoices to the state, essentially saying, here's the cost we incurred for these students, now pay it. Others have a more complex system where there may be many different levels of need and then different factors for those different levels. That's another system we could go to, but it's those intensives, it's difficult because those costs do have to be paid by the district. It's just a question of how does the state choose to fund it, as we do have the constitutional responsibility to provide for a system of public schools.
One more follow-up on that.
We just have so much in front of us that I'm going to have to try to keep people to let's just keep moving on and then make a list of your questions, if you would.
Okay, going on to slide 13. So this is the base student allocation history in just nominal dollars. As I mentioned, it's kind of just looking at the BSA alone is kind of misleading because it doesn't include all funding, so I'm going to go over this one fairly fast. There was a significant increase in the BSA from FY05 through 07 in the early part of this. The BSA has not changed a whole lot since then, gone from 5380 to this year 5960. This next graph adjusts that for FY22 dollars, so you can see that over the last 20 years, the peak BSA year was FY07, the last year of that three-year increase, and then it has declined since then. When there's been these major increases, FY17, for example, was the last year, FY15 was really the last year of that increase, it'll be higher and then it'll drop back off. As you can see, it's relatively flat. So today, the base student allocation is lowest it's been in the last 20 years, adjusted for inflation. And again, this is in FY22 dollars, so FY23 and 24 are based in 2.5% inflation projections for those years. This next slide, I think, is probably more useful. It looks at basic need because, again, puts those two things together, those differences in the factors and then the differences in the BSA into the total amount of funding. So in terms of nominal dollars, the required local contributions, you can see, have increased this whole period despite the 4% going down to 2.65%. The deductible state impact aid has also increased. The state funding has increased over the period, but has been relatively flat since around FY18. And this is, again, before we talk about outside the formula funding. If we get into FY22 dollars, you can see that today's funding is actually around the same level as FY05. So despite the BSA being $1,000 lower, those factors are much bigger. And as a result, in terms of the total funding, the amounts in FY04 and 05 and 24 are relatively similar. Again, they're at the bottom of this 20-year range. So you see this increase as the factors went up and the BSA went up, with the peak total funding level year in basic need being FY17, and then now we're back down to that FY05 level in terms of total funding total basic need in inflation-adjusted dollars. One thing I would note is that the factor changes don't impact all districts equally. Anchorage is one in all of these scenarios because it's always been the base. So Anchorage did not receive an increase from the school size factor changes. Other districts did. So when you look at FY05 and 24 being the same, on a district-by-district level, they may not be the same. There may be some that benefited from those higher school size factor adjustments and others that did not. So it's not necessarily, even though the total amounts are equivalent, on a district-by-district basis, there may be substantial differences in the amounts of funding they're getting now as 20 years ago on an inflation-adjusted basis. In this slide, we're layering in two other items. So the red here is the pupil transportation formula. So the pupil transportation formula goes to districts that operate a pupil transportation system. Buses are, in one case, I believe they use aircraft. And those amounts are, since FY15, have been a fixed amount per student with no adjustments. Prior to that, there had been periodic inflation adjustments. The last one was rolled in FY13 through 15. The program originally was a state reimbursement program where we'd reimburse the actual costs experienced by districts. It switched to a per ADM grant and then was rebased a few times in the mid 2000s and early 2010s to try to adjust to the actual cost that districts were experiencing. So even though it was still a flat or a per ADM amount by district, that per district amount was changed to match the actual cost experienced by the district. That hasn't occurred in over a decade, and it has not been inflation adjusted since FY15. The green is additional formula funding on top of the formula. So in quite a few of these years, you can see that the state provided funding on top of the base student allocation formula to be distributed according to the formula, including that $57 million last year that I think we've discussed several times in this committee. And then this is the same thing in FY22 dollars. So again, you know, layering those amounts in. If we layer those in, the top year is no longer FY17 as it is through just base student allocation. It's now FY15 because in FY15 there was outside the formula funding that went out to districts. So if you look at total funding through these formulas to districts, the peak year with respect to inflation is FY15. And in FY24, again, we're pretty comparable to FY05 at the bottom of this 20-year chart. This next graph layers in, again, going back to nominal dollars, the additional local contribution. So this is the optional funding from local governments. So this is kind of getting the, not quite the total picture, but the total funding that goes out through the formula and through municipal appropriations. And so those amounts have increased a little bit over time. Since they are based on basic need, they can't really increase much faster than basic need, though. So as a proportion, those additional local contributions have not changed a whole lot over time. And again, slide 20, this adds the inflation adjustments, and it's a pretty similar picture to the last few. And I know I'm going pretty fast, so when we get to questions at the end, I'm happy to turn back to any of these. So last slide before the appendices, the funding levers for the legislature. So the legislature has several levers to impact school district funding, and each have different impacts to districts and to the state's finances. So the base student allocation is the one that gets the most attention. It provides across-the-board funding to all school districts on an equal per-adjusted student basis. So that is one of the ways we can provide a change in funding to the districts. We can provide outside the formula funding. Is distributed the same, but is a one-time item. It's just through the budget. So that means the districts don't necessarily want to build that at their base, but they do get the money the same as if it was in the formula. Changing the formula factors would be targeted changes that could affect districts differently. So if we change the district cost factors, it would not go out to all districts equally. It could result in some districts getting more funding, some districts getting less funding. But you could target funding to particular districts if you know there's particular districts that are needier, particular types of districts. You could develop changes in the formula that could address that in a more targeted way. It's probably more difficult to figure out how to address those things. In the past, we've often had studies to figure out those cost factors. And even then, we had multiple failed studies before we got to one the legislature actually implemented. Another funding lever is the TERS on behalf payment cap, that 12.5%. So if we adjusted that up or down, we could change the amount that districts pay in their budget. So that essentially provides an equal amount of funding on a per employee basis or for their salary basis rather than per student. So if you compare the difference of changing TERS funding or the BSA by an equivalent amount for each of those two items, the two changes would impact districts differently. Another change would be to change the required local contribution, change that 2.65 mils. That would shift who pays between the state and local governments, but wouldn't necessarily impact how much money districts are getting. And then again, as I talked a little bit about the local contribution cap, changing that could allow greater contributions by some municipalities, but it could result in losing an equalized formula, which would increase the state costs, but could provide more funding to some districts because they would get to keep their impact aid and they could potentially contribute more as well. So there's a number of levers the legislature has in front of you. They each have very different impacts on districts. We can help you provide you numbers of how different ones would impact districts. There's actually a few even beyond this that are more complex, and not getting into there, but there's a number of ways the legislature could impact education funding beyond just the base student allocation. And so I have a few appendices after this. Those are just basically the numbers behind some of the slides if you're curious about seeing the numbers instead of just the graphical thing. So I'm not going to go through those, but they're there for your reference.
Okay. We may have some pent-up questions. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, I'd like it if we could go to your favorite slide, number 12, and just one more quick question on that, and then I have one other question on transportation, if I could. So for this particular area, I'm really wanting to zero in on the, I know that it gradually went up to the 13 factor, I think is where we're at, the special ed factor was increased to eventually 13 by the time it got to FY12, and hearing a lot of buzz about that in various news reports, and I want to make sure to clarify because I think it's important that we appreciate the bigger conversation around this. My understanding, and I'd like to hear your input, is that if we were to change this in a way that wasn't looking at specific students, for example, it would be to the detriment of some of our rural communities in particular. And that's something I wondered if you'd looked at or thought about, first of all. And I have one other question on transportation.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So if we got rid of that SPED factor and just turned it into a block grant, for example, like the special needs factor, the result is that the districts that have a disproportionate number of those students for whatever reason would be face very high costs that they wouldn't have the funding to deal with. And so I've looked at the SPED count by district, and it is not equivalent. The students are just not equally distributed throughout the state. There's significant differences on a district by district level. And so there would be some districts that, would probably be better off because they have relatively few. Other districts, maybe some small districts especially, may just not have the resources to handle those costs if it's not directed. And similarly with special needs, where we have the block grant, there was a study the legislature commissioned back in 2015 that looked at our formula. And one of the things that study talked about was whether we should convert our special needs factor into a per student formula that would provide different levels of funding based on counts of special needs students. And it found that there are significant differences in the number of special needs students, especially English language learners, by district. And so that study recommended exploring turning that block grant into a counted program like the SPED program. Because, again, there are differences in the underlying characteristics of districts that block grant doesn't quite get to. But like the SPED does, but that's only certain students from that highest level of need.
Thank you, Chair. I really appreciate that explanation. I want to make sure that we're not setting ourselves up for litigation, particularly around that work. The other question I had is related to transportation, if I may, Chair.
Yes, you may.
Thank you so much. So this is related to, I'm thinking about our per pupil transportation. It sounds like that has changed. Originally, there was a reimbursement. In consideration of the larger districts, I think of MATSU, for example, and the idea that the buses have to run no matter what, whether they're picking up one student or 24 students. And if we haven't changed that since 2015, we know that we've tried to locally put in what we can. Would it be more beneficial for some of these districts if we did move to back to the receipts for these larger districts, or would that not make much of a difference?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So, I looked at the reasoning behind why the legislature chose to go from the reimbursement method to a per student method, although, you know, it's a different per student amount by district based on their historical costs. The reason the legislature did that was to try to ensure that the accountability for the funding was with the districts, where they would try to get the, you know, provide the services for the lowest cost they could, because they'd be getting a set amount of money rather than getting reimbursed no matter what their costs were. Mm-hmm. But then the legislature did go through and kind of rebase those numbers repeatedly a few times, where they would look at what are districts actually spending on pupil transportation versus how much money are we giving them? Do we need to change these per student factors by district? And they did that, I think most recently was FY, it was in 2012, so it may have been FY13 when that was rolled in. So, you know, it's a policy choice of how to deal with it, but we have not gone back and looked at are the costs that districts are incurring for pupil transportation being adequately covered by that pupil transportation formula? Are some districts overfunded and pulling that money for other purposes, or underfunded and putting foundation money in? That's something the legislature has not done in about a decade.
Thank you. Follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
So with regard to transportation funding and funding our classroom learning, both of those pieces, it sounds like we have in place opportunities to shore them up in a way that would be lasting, or we could do, you mentioned at the, I think your last slide, one-time funding. Would you share with us what you're hearing from educators, if that, or superintendents, about what the difference would be? Why would one prefer one-time funding as opposed to something that's more systemic through BSA and such?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I can't say that I've actually talked to any superintendents this year, but generally, you know, the districts would prefer to have the money be predictable, meaning into the base student allocation. If it's one-time funding, that would mean that it would come out next year, just as the $57 million that came out in FY23 is out of the base budget in FY24. So it gives more consistency year to year. If the legislature feels like you want to provide more money than you're comfortable giving out permanently, that's where I think outside the formula money has been used, is to sort of buy time to look at other things. But from the district standpoint, obviously they would prefer just getting more money in statute versus in the appropriation bill.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Painter. That was very in-depth and exhaustive. Appreciate it very much. The next House Finance Committee is scheduled for Wednesday, March 1, 2023, at 1:30 p.m. and we will hear a budget overview from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and then a budget overview from the Alaska Court System. With no further business before the committee, at 3:49, we are adjourned.